Oh, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Isn't it beautiful and cool and cloudy? And it feels like all the plants are just kind of going, and so are we. Kind of different to be grateful for rain in our climate, but we certainly are. Especially, Michael and I live out in the country and we have a well, and it's not a really deep one. So we've been hauling water to keep our veggies alive. So it's been a good practice to be really, really aware of water and really grateful for it, because we can so take it for granted in our part of the world. So, when I was thinking about what I wanted to talk about today, it wasn't actually water. I was first inclined to follow up on a talk that Michael did last month. And he talked about making the invisible visible. Some of you remember that? Some of you were here. It was a really moving talk for me. And I suspect it was also for any of you who were there who have ever had the experience of feeling invisible or of trying to avoid being visible in your life. And when I was thinking about that, it occurred to me that Dharma talks are conversations. I mean, obviously, I'm the one talking at the moment. It's one of those Zen practice things when you sit in the timekeeper's position, you keep time. When you sit in the bell ringer's position, you ring the bells. And when you sit over here in the Eno's position, you help people know what to do in the Zendo. And when you take any Zazen seat, you take your seat. You do your practice, and then you get up. And you let that go, and you do the next thing. So it's sort of like that when you sit in this seat and do a Dharma talk. So although I'm the one speaking at the moment, I feel like I'm also having a conversation with Michael in his talk last month, and with the Buddha, with Dogen Zenji, and the various ancestors. And also with each of you, as you respond, even without speaking, to what I say. And the conversation then flows onward in our practice together, whether we make direct reference to our Dharma talks or not. So when I was thinking about this subject, I was also reflecting that I am eminently qualified to comment on invisibility issues. Because the first Dharma name my Zen teacher gave me was Kakushi. He meant it to mean enlightenment worker. Two characters, enlightenment worker. Because he knew I struggled and have struggled to free myself, to do my true work in the world. What the poet Gary Snyder called the real work. I suppose an enlightenment worker is kind of what a bodhisattva is. Though the Japanese characters for my name would suggest something more like enlightenment smith, like blacksmith, or enlightenment right, like as in wheelwright. Maybe enlightenment mason, like stonemason. And a Japanese person, just hearing that name without seeing the characters, which are totally uncharacteristic as a Dharma name, would assume that my name was Enlightenment Warrior, which never really fit for me. But the other thing about this koan, this riddle of a Dharma name that my teacher gave me, is that it's a pun on the Japanese word for hidden, kakushi. Kakushi Goku means hiding game, which we call hide and seek. There's something primal about hide and seek. We play at hiding, being safe from harm, from abuse, shame, ridicule, criticism, and yet we yearn to be found, to be seen, heard, recognized, loved for who we are. And there's something heartbreaking about the child who hides in the game and everyone else wanders off and forgets about him or her. My mother used to tell a story about how when I was very young, I could sing all the verses to the Davy Crockett song. If you know Davy Crockett, and there was a TV show that really dates you. Born on a mountaintop in Tennessee. And then something about the land of the free and killing a bear before he was three. But I would refuse to sing it in front of my relatives unless I went into the bathroom and belted it out from the safety of invisibility. Right? They can't see me, I can't see them. I don't have a very clear memory of this because it became such, became a story. But my feeling of it, of that sort of non-memory, vague memory, is of avoiding ridicule. In my family, a precocious child was something laughable, like a dog dancing on its hind legs. Children have a hard time understanding adult reactions to their spontaneous and exuberant expressions. Some children learn to perform for applause. Some learn to duck and cover. It's curious and a little ironic to me that putting on a Zen priest's robe was and continues to be for me an exercise in no place to hide. Although it might appear to be a kind of uniform. And as a priest in the world, I don't wear it all the time. I go out in street clothes. And yet I feel more hidden without it, in the street clothes. The robe holds me upright in my practice, and it reminds me that wisdom and compassion are my guideposts, that my vow is to see deeply into the karmic roots of any fear, aversion, or self-clinging that arises in me, and believe me, they do, so that I can, to whatever extent, ease the suffering in this world. As I've been reflecting on all this, I've realized that the challenge for me has often been as much being heard as being seen. For those of us who have been strongly conditioned not to speak out, doing so is an act of will. And sometimes we undercompensate or overcompensate. Sometimes we clam up. You may know someone who does that, who holds back, who doesn't offer their perspective unless invited, and maybe not even then. Or you may be or know someone who's over-insistent on getting their point across, who goes on and on and on and repeats themselves. I've been both. Maybe you have too. When someone else is going on and on and on, it can be tiresome and annoying or threatening, particularly if you're not getting a word in edgewise. It may be helpful to consider that the very person who seems to be taking up more than their share of airspace may suffer from a chronic belief that they will not be heard and respected. Just like the ones who clam up. We could all benefit so much in our relationships from slowing down, sitting together in silence, or savoring a cup of tea together, and then face to face, within reach of a steadying hand, taking turns to speak and listen, and then checking to see if we've understood. Such a simple practice, and so easy to forget in our rush to get things done. Our practice of right speech being one of the Eightfold Path that the Buddha taught, can be a good guide to us. And we also have the precepts of not gossiping, not speaking ill of others, using kind speech. And we also have the Buddha's advice to consider before we tell someone what we think would be good for them to hear. Whether it's timely, whether it's true, whether it's kind, and whether it's beneficial. Imagine if we all practiced that. Now, I've been talking mostly about speaking out in our personal relationships, but what about the public sphere? What about our social and political relationships and environment? In the current climate of social media knee-jerk responses and if you're not for me, you're against me stances, it can be quite hard to sort out how to respond to the issues that we care really deeply about with some depth and some subtlety. How to bring both the wisdom and compassion of our practice to bear in meaningful ways amongst the yelling and posturing all too common in public discourse. This has been an ongoing question in my life. Although the injunctions against speaking up have been strong in my upbringing, I've often not felt content with many of the options or models for speaking, for how to speak out that my society has offered. All too often, I've let opportunities to speak out slip by. Opportunities to find the language to speak about human wrongdoing, cruelty, and injustice, and as well to speak out about human courage, creativity, and caring. So these kinds of questions have been on my mind this past couple of weeks. Really much, much longer. Particularly as I've reflected on race relations in the United States. The shock of the shooting of those gentle churchgoers in Charleston, I guess it's been almost 3 weeks now, is still resonating in my heart. Along with the elation to hear that state governors were going to take down the Confederate flag, and then the disheartenment at the subsequent church burnings. That country of my birth, still so divided, still so caught up in hatred and delusion, still playing out the legacy of slavery. I was too young to have played a role in the civil rights movement, though I have quite a few friends who did travel to the South and volunteer. But I do remember when Martin Luther King was assassinated, and I remember attending a rally in a shabby old armory in Trenton, New Jersey, when I was in high school. And so I've been remembering lately what shaped my view of race growing up. My family lived in the countryside, outside of a small town in Hopewell, New Jersey, central New Jersey, little town, the population of less than 4,000. My family attended the Calvary Baptist Church, a classic white clapboard structure at the main intersection of town across from the bank and the drugstore. Some blocks away was a 2-block-long stretch of Columbia Street where all the black people in our town lived. And they attended the Second Calvary Baptist Church, which was a smaller, plainer version of ours. Others of the black population lived in the hills to the north of town, where they attended the Zion African Methodist Episcopal Church. So my formative memories of race relations in my country of birth center around church. One incident. I'm going to just share 3 incidents. I remember being taken, when I was quite young, taken along on part of a church delegation to take Christmas baskets to the slums of Newark, New Jersey. These slums were reputed to be the worst in the country, and they were pretty grim. There's a clipping, a newspaper clipping of this delegation that my mother saved, which shows me, maybe I'm 8 or 9 years old, but it doesn't show the apartment we visited, which is the only memory I have of this occasion. My memory is that it had only 2 rooms, a kitchen, which was pretty bare except for a chrome table and chairs, and a second room in which it seemed like there were maybe 5 or 6 children, and that it served as a bedroom. At the kitchen table sat a massive black woman wearing a short, tight skirt and a sleeveless undershirt. With a look, she commanded her children not to come in from the bedroom. Her physical presence alone was awe-inspiring, but it was her utter emotional impassivity, impenetrability. She sat there like a rock, refusing to be shamed by us. She did not smile, she hardly spoke. Our piety bounced off her and pierced my heart as deeply wrong and unjust. I was the one who felt shamed, and I didn't understand it. Incident 2. My mother took my sister and me, perhaps I was 10 and my sister 7, to an evening performance at the Second Calvary Baptist Church of Earl Hubbard's All-Girl Chorus from Trenton. Earl was a small, vigorous, wrinkled black man, and the chorus members were not girls, but substantial black women wearing choir robes. When they sang Joshua Fit the Battle of Jericho, they shook the foundations of that little church. When they sang, "Were you there when they crucified my Lord?" it sent shivers up my spine. Especially when they came to, "Oh, sometimes it causes me to tremble. Tremble, tremble." It wasn't some kind of conversion experience that I had, but it felt, I think what it was a direct hit of soul. Though I could not have named it, it was something our prim and pallid hymns did not have. Incident 3. Probably 2 or 3 years later, Second Calvary was without a minister for some months. At one of the periodic meetings of our church membership, someone made a motion to invite the congregation of Second Calvary to come and worship with us. It was voted down, ostensibly because they knew they were welcome, but they wouldn't be comfortable here. Our minister, who preferred to talk about civil rights rather than hellfire and brimstone, left the church soon after. And I left soon after that. I was 12. I remember the few black students at school being quiet and shy. I don't even remember any being in my classes in the early grades. And yet, how could that have been so? From fourth grade on, we were streamed by academic performance, so I was always in the smart class, which had no black students. But throughout high school, every morning, I was seated in homeroom class, Mrs. Day's home ec room, in alphabetical order, which put me next to Bobby McAkern, who was a tall, skinny black boy who'd spent his years in the dumb classes while I was in the smart classes. So in the mornings, I helped him with his math homework. And he stood beside me as I refused to put my hand on my heart and pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, with liberty and justice for all. Because there wasn't liberty and justice for all. But he was perhaps the one person in my life who noticed how deeply unhappy I was in those years. I don't have any black friends here in this very different culture of Vancouver, where racial and ethnic groups mix more than in many parts of the world, but where the human tendency to tribal loyalty is still strong. You know, we hang out with mostly who's familiar. And yet that church shooting far away in Charleston hit me in the solar plexus. So I felt the need to say something, or maybe to sing a lamentation, or to extend the conversation. I started with a Dharma talk I did a while ago on justice and compassion, which ended up being about restorative justice. Already, the folks at Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Charleston have been modeling restorative justice by extending forgiveness to that deeply deluded young man who struck down their loved ones. But there's another kind of justice that I didn't talk about in that earlier talk, distributive justice, how society distributes power, resources, services, opportunities among its members, and on what basis. If you want to read a really clear and thoughtful discussion of this, I'd really recommend this book, Michael Sandel's Justice, particularly on his chapters on what do we owe one another, dilemmas of loyalty, and his last chapter called Justice and the Common Good. I can't even begin, really, to give you some of the insights that I got reading this book, but it helped me to understand more clearly how lacking our contemporary society is in justice based on valuing the common good. Although we give lip service to that, you know, so often it's the bottom line of profit or interests in our tribe in retaining the benefits and perks that our tribe has. Although we could argue that Canadians in general are more willing than Americans to accept limits on individual freedom for the sake of the common good. Yet, we too face the question of whether and how we are responsible for harms and injustices done by our predecessors. That question is really up these days. Just as Americans say, well, my ancestors never had slaves, that all happened a long time ago. I'm not prejudiced. How can they be mad at me? Canadians say, sometimes of residential schools or native land claims. Look, that all happened in the past, before my time. Can't they just move on? Why should I have to pay the price of reparations? But these are expressions of a kind of moral individualism that prevents us from thinking in terms of collective responsibility. According to philosopher Alistair MacIntyre, quoted in this book, that kind of thinking assumes that the self is detachable from its social and historical roles and statuses, and thus, by extension, bears no responsibility towards future generations. I still often remember years ago when I was at UBC, it was probably the early 80s, I attended a panel discussion. And on the panel was an executive, a professor from the Department of Forestry, an executive from the then logging giant Macmillan Bloedel, and a native land claims lawyer whose name I was pleased to see was John McCandless. That's my surname. A distant cousin, perhaps. And during the question and answer period, a woman stood up and asked the Mac Blow executive what kind of world he envisioned leaving his grandchildren. He laughed and said, "Oh, I'm not old enough to have grandchildren. My son has just graduated from the forestry department here, and I'm proud to say he's going to follow in my footsteps." His vanity was so great that he couldn't see as far as his own son's children, let alone the 7 generations native traditions take into consideration. Have you heard that? You know, thinking there's even a brand of toilet paper called 7 Generations. Right. And that's where the name comes from. That tradition of thinking 7 generations ahead when we look at our decisions about how we take care of our environment. Recycled toilet paper, needless to say. It's so easy for us to identify with what we see as the needs and benefits of our own tribe, and to see the needs of another tribe as a threat. That young man in Charleston said, "You're raping our women, you're taking over our country. Us and them." Roger William, the chief of the Chilcotin Nation, worked for 25 years to see his people's land claims vindicated last year by the Supreme Court of Canada. When asked what he would like to say to those who worry that the Canadian economy will suffer if First Nations get control of too much land, he responded, "We want to prove that theory wrong. If you can improve First Nations life, it will improve the province and Canada." Imagine if we could really believe that. Last January, BC's Attorney General, Jeff Plant, who had himself for years argued against native land claims, made a speech praising the Supreme Court decision, in which he admitted that he had been, and these are his words, on the wrong side of the wall of fear. And he added, "I think we need to throw ourselves over that wall and realize actually that it's not so scary." Our practice, our meditation practice, invites us to look deeply into the nature of the self, to see that what we identify with as me and mine is both conditioned and impermanent, that what we think of as our self is inextricably embedded in a matrix of interrelationships with other beings, and that there is no true happiness, well-being, or liberation for us, apart from the freedom of all beings from suffering. That's the realization of a bodhisattva. Our practice is to go deeply into silence the silence and spaciousness of boundless Buddha nature. And yet, living in this human world, sometimes we also must speak and act. You have to say something, is the book here, the title of a book of Dharma talks by Katagiri Roshi, a Japanese Zen teacher who came to San Francisco Zen Center and helped Suzuki Roshi there, and then went on to found Minnesota Zen Center and taught for many years in Minneapolis. This is what he says. A monk once asked his master, "What is the essence of Buddhism?" The master said, "Step forward from the top of a 100-foot pole." "How can we go forward from the top of the pole?" "We'll die." "Can we go backward?" "No, we cannot." "What then does it mean to step forward from the top of a 100-foot pole?" Though we are not always conscious of it, we actually face this question daily. As we do become aware of it, we finally ask ourselves, "What is life?" But there's nothing to say. Just silence. This silence is Buddha nature, or suchness, or emptiness. Though everyone experiences this silence, we usually don't notice it because our minds are very busy. Sooner or later, though, we all realize its presence. But then we ask, "What is this silence? How can I speak of it? Do I just keep my mouth shut?" No, I don't think so. Even if you don't say anything, there's still a problem. Silence, Buddha nature, is not something apart from your life. It compels you to speak. That is why the Zen master had to speak. He had to say something. He had to speak from that silence, from Buddha nature. When you really understand your life, when you really understand what makes it possible for all beings to exist, there's nothing to say. You just keep silent. But still, you have to say something. This is why I always tell you to keep your mouth shut and act with a true heart. Does it sound paradoxical? Yes. And yet. Buddha nature is the state of your life as you stand atop a 100-foot pole. You have to do something. You have to say something. Take one step. So there are many koans in the Zen literature, like the one he mentions, where the Zen monk must take a risk, must speak or act spontaneously in the moment, not freeze or hide out or put up a facade. There are times when we have to step off the 100-foot pole, throw ourselves over the wall of fear. Sometimes we have to speak and act from our deepest heartfelt aspiration. We have to risk authenticity and stay as grounded as we can in our personal relationships and in the social and political sphere that we live in, because we know that our well-being is not independent of the well-being of the young black man apprehended for walking down the street in a hoodie, the First Nations communities whose water is contaminated with toxins downstream from tar sands mines, schoolgirls in Afghanistan or Nigeria who risk their lives to pursue their passion for learning. The list is endless. You can make your own list. And so we risk speaking out in our personal relationships and in our lives and community. Sometimes we feel awkward and inarticulate or not smart and sophisticated enough. We don't always get it right, but we can't give up and go back into hiding. We have to try again. Maybe we express our caring for the world through visual art or movement or offering our labor and skills. We're not all people of words, and that's just as well. We speak with our eyes and our hands, our feet in walking. And our stillness speaks too. when those around us are agitated and anxious. The world needs us to be visible, to make our voices heard, our actions seen, and our caring felt. The world needs us to continue the conversation. So I thank you very much for listening to my words. Yeah.